Thank you very much, friends. It's really a pleasure to be back in the area and to be with you all, and especially to intrude on your time in the middle of the week. You still came. I appreciate that. Friends, this is really a wonderful time in the Baha'i world. Very exciting things happening in all parts of the world. A great victory really won this last Rizwan, where all over the Baha'i world, the friends were able to achieve at least 1,500 intensive programs of growth, a goal which was set out years ago by the House of Justice. For 5 years, we were able to achieve that in a four-year period and surpass it. And the American Baha'i community really played a large part in that victory and in the movement of the process in the Americas, and contributed a lion's share to the total in the whole Baha'i world. So you have worked hard, you have really achieved very significant things, and always with every achievement in the faith, one accomplishment sets the stage for the next stage in our work. So we are particularly blessed to have one extra year before the introduction of the new plan. And so you wouldn't get bored, you probably saw this letter from the House of Justice that it was a little different than the Rizwan message of 2009 by about 32 paragraphs or so. But in that message then, you see direction that the House of Justice has given. Again, it's because of what you were able to accomplish that then the House of Justice could give so much guidance that really reflects back the learning from all different parts of the Baha'i world and focuses us on this next year. Yes, that's 11 pages for 1 year. And then you see what happens in the next plan. So more guidance after that. But particularly, I think these achievements, it wouldn't be complete without also noting the very significant things that are happening now in Iran and the real sacrificial efforts of the friends in the community who are contributing, even in spite of all the hardships and difficulties they're facing, their share to the progress of the faith, by their steadfastness, by their looking for ways, even in spite of all this hardship and oppression, to find some way to speak to their fellow citizens and to make their contribution to the advancement of their society, just as Baha'is in all parts of the world are struggling to make the contribution wherever they live. We certainly benefit by their example. We have the freedom to act where they don't, and yet by their courage and their heroism, we can see really the changing consciousness of Iranians, those in Iran, those outside of Iran, unprecedented change in perspective about the faith and about the contributions that are made by the Baha'is. So even though there are sacrifices being made in all these parts of the world, those sacrifices are bearing fruit in these victories that we're seeing. Now, in a way, it's a little difficult to give a talk about the current things happening with the faith, especially after the House of Justice wrote that message. I mean, if the House of Justice had something to say, the House of Justice said it there, I can assure you. And so a little on my part, what I have to add is certainly it's the comment of an individual. And I'm really kind of maybe saying some things around the message rather than try to interpret that message for you. After the Rizwan message was shared with members of the Teaching Center and the House of Justice, and the Teaching Center had a consultation, one of the members of the House of Justice wisely pointed out to the Teaching Center that after such a message is complete, now the members of the House of Justice individually also have to go back and look at that message and study it and understand it. I mean, it's one thing to have in your mind and participate in a consultation and share ideas. It's a very different kind of thing than to have the joint decision of the Universal House of Justice, and now this is the statement, this is the guidance, and then every individual, including the members of the House of Justice, now have to have a shift in their thought to catch up with this measure of guidance, fresh measure of guidance that we've received. All of those different thoughts that didn't end up in the letter, no matter how brilliant your idea was, somehow it didn't find its way in the final draft. Well, it wasn't quite as brilliant as maybe you thought it was. And so you have to make sure then that you really understand, like any other Baha'i, what is it that the House of Justice is saying and what is it that we have to do. So my comments, I'm not going to try to explain that letter to you. It's a challenge now for every cluster in all the parts of the Baha'i world for the Friends to look at that guidance look at it afresh, look at their own experience, their own strengths, their own challenges, and be able to draw from that guidance the insights they need to act in the next four cycles, actually getting closer to three cycles now, until the end of the plan, when the House of Justice will give us then the next step in this series of plans leading to the end of the first century of the formative age, all focused on the single aim of advancing the process of entry by troops. What I hope to do with my brief comments is to really just kind of maybe say a couple things to allow us to kind of step back for a minute. I mean, you've all worked very hard. You notice, again, in the 2009 message, it was very brief because you were working hard and you were doing the right thing and you needed to do more of it. But now, having achieved that very challenging goal, we have the chance to kind of step back, just for pause for maybe just this evening, and then you have to stop pausing and get back to work. But pause for just this evening and really think a little bit about, all right, let's kind of get our bearings a little bit. What is it that we're doing, after all? Let's remind ourselves. What are we doing? Where have we been? Where are we now? Where are we going next? So with that little bit of orientation, then, when we go back and look at this message and go back to our clusters and think what we'll do, this will hopefully give us a little bit of perspective. Now, I think it's very interesting if you haven't, I know the message itself is quite a challenge to study and really grasp its meaning. But as time permits, it's also a very useful kind of exercise to go and to go back and look at a few of those messages from 1995, 96 that started the four-year plan or that pertained to the 12-month plan or the first five-year plan. And then read that in the context of the current Rizwan message. Because what you get is a very striking sense of where we were and how far we've come since that time 14 years ago in 1996 when the four-year plan was first established. If you look, for example, at a number of statements of the House of Justice, one of the things that it spoke about back in that time was the importance of raising up teachers. So in 1995, the House of Justice said, thousands and thousands of believers will need to be aided to express the vitality of their faith through constancy in teaching the cause and by supporting the plans of their institutions and the endeavors of their communities. All right? There was a need to raise up thousands and thousands who could teach the cause. Now, in the current Rizwan message, the House of Justice says, even the most modest estimates suggest that there are now tens of thousands who participate in periodic campaigns to establish ties of friendship on the basis of shared understanding with those previously regarded as strangers. So what was only a challenge, a hope, something we didn't know how to do, and we can only aspire to raise up thousands of the, and upon thousands, now, the most modest estimates give tens of thousands who can engage in this process. The House of Justice wrote in 1995 about the challenge that we had with growth where we weren't able to sustain the process once it began. They wrote, with the growth in the number of enrollments, it has become apparent that such occasional courses of instruction and the informal activities of community life, though important, are not sufficient as a means of human resource development, for they have resulted only in a relatively small band of active supporters of the cause. These believers, no matter how dedicated, no matter how willing to make sacrifices, cannot attend to the needs of hundreds, much less thousands, of fledgling local communities. Systematic attention has to be given by Baha'i institutions to training a significant number of believers and assisting them in serving the cause according to their God-given talents and capacities. The development of human resources on a large scale requires that the establishment of institutes be viewed in a new light. So the House of Justice is defining the heart of the problem. We can enlist thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the faith, but our capacity through deepening summer schools and other means is limited in its ability to raise up the workers who can sustain that process. So we have to learn about this whole thing about institutes in a new light. And we didn't really know how to do it. We had some idea. We did different things. We tried different things in different countries. We weren't able to sustain it. And we did that for 14 years. And now the House of Justice writes, the new pattern of deepening that combines knowledge with action to translate teachings into reality, the worldwide the worldwide Baha'i community has acquired the capacity to enable thousands, nay millions, to study the writings in small groups with the explicit purpose of translating the Baha'i teachings into reality. So we've built an institutional capacity in the Baha'i world so that millions of people can be engaged in a process of study and a process that involves tying study with action. And so then those friends can learn right from the beginning, or even if they're not Baha'is, how certain insights from Baha'u'llah's teachings can be translated into reality and action. The House of Justice wrote also about many other subjects. They all, if you go back and you look at the subjects raised in the letter, you go back and compare some of these earlier quotations, you'll see one thing after another, children's classes, devotional life, the institution, the role of the institutions. The House of Justice wrote at the time that the maturity of the spiritual assembly must be measured not only by the regularity of its meetings and the efficiency of its functioning, but also by the continuity of the growth of Baha'i membership, the effectiveness of the interaction between the assembly and the members of its community, the quality of the spiritual and social life of the community, and the overall sense of vitality of a community in the process of dynamic, ever-advancing development. So the House of Justice redefined the work of the local assembly and the relationship between the local spiritual assembly and the community. And today it writes, evolving relationships among administrative structures have brought the local spiritual assembly to the threshold of a new stage in the exercise of its responsibility to diffuse the word of God, to mobilize the energies of the believers, and to forge an environment that is spiritually edifying. So we're seeing what we didn't know how to do 14 years ago. We're seeing that evident in many of these clusters in the world where the local assembly plays a fundamental part in creating this dynamic vitality in the cluster, contributing to the plan of the cluster, but also the pattern in the local community. So these are just some of the many examples, and I encourage you to kind of go back and look at that and study. And the last point is that, again, it's very interesting, the overall purpose of our mission. The House of Justice reminded us then, as it did now, that the aim is not merely the growth of the Baha'i community, so that our numbers increase, you know, so that more Baha'i, there's more people in Baha'i Church than there were before. It's not that at all. It's about a process of civilization building. As quoted in the message, Baha'u'llah's statement, that the object of every revelation is to effect a transformation in the inner and outward life of humanity. And if that transformation is not seen, then the futility of God's universal manifestation is evident. And Baha'u'llah's purpose in coming was to give, in his revelation, such means as lead to the elevation, the advancement, the education, the protection, and the regeneration of the peoples of the earth have been clearly set forth by us and are revealed in the holy books and tablets. So in 1995, the House of Justice noted, as humanity is tossed and tormented by the ravages inflicted upon it by a civilization gone out of control, let us keep our heads and hearts focused on the divine tasks set before us. This plan is meant to prepare our community to cope with the accelerating changes that are occurring in the world around us, to place the community in a position both to withstand the weight of the accompanying tests and challenges, and to make more visible a pattern of functioning in which the world can turn for aid and example in the wake of a tumultuous transition. And then again in the Rizvan message in 2010. Baha'u'llah's revelation is vast. It calls for a profound change not only at the level of the individual, but also in the structure of society. The work advancing in every corner of the globe today represents the latest stage of the ongoing Baha'i endeavor to create the nucleus of the glorious civilization enshrined in his teachings. Only as effort is made to draw on insights from his revelation, to tap into the accumulating knowledge of the human race, to apply his teachings intelligently to the life of humanity, and to consult on questions that arise, will the necessary learning occur and capacity be developed. So that was our aim then, that is our aim now, and we were at a point 14 years ago where many of these elements, we didn't know how to do it, we saw we needed to do it, and now 14 years later, we have seen these hopes and aspirations brought into reality. Now then, that brings us, that's where we were, that brings us up to this point of where we are now. Again, the details of that are in the Rizvan message. I won't try to summarize what you already know so well and what you'll continue to study throughout the course of the year. But in essence, I think you could kind of look at the practical work that we're trying to accomplish in our clusters and see basically three elements to this, I think, which draw together a number of these different pieces. One is that we're trying to create a coherent pattern of activity in our cluster that creates a vibrant pattern of community life, an environment open to all in which they can come and experience the Word of God and then respond to it, whether they become Baha'is, whether they don't become Baha'is. But it's that vitality of life and that integrated pattern, that coherent pattern of activity that we're striving to create. So all of these different diverse elements, devotional meetings, children's classes, study circles, teaching activities of various kinds, added to the other elements. The House of Justice mentioned this at the beginning of the five-year plan itself, to which we're working right now. It talked about this pattern of coherence. On several occasions, we've made reference to the coherence that is brought to the process of growth through the establishment of study circles, devotional meetings, and children's classes. The steady multiplication of core activities propelled by the Training Institute creates a sustainable pattern of expansion and consolidation that is at once structured and organic. As seekers join these activities and declare their faith, individual and collective teaching endeavors gather momentum. And through the effort made to ensure that a percentage of the new believers enroll in the Institute courses, the pool of human resources required to carry out the work of the faith swells. When strenuously pursued in a cluster, all of this activity eventually brings about conditions favorable for launching an intensive program of growth. And then they talk about elements, the elements, how the study and application of the teachings become a pervasive habit. The spirit of communal worship generated by devotional meetings begins to permeate the community's collective consciousness, collective endeavors, excuse me. A graceful integration of the arts into diverse activities enhances the surge of energy that mobilizes the believers. Classes for the spiritual education of children and junior youth serve to strengthen the roots of the faith in the population. Even an act as simple as visiting the home of a new believer, whether in a village or in a city, reinforces ties of fellowship that bind the members of the community together. And in addition to that, then, the feast flourishes. The assembly meeting now becomes very focused on the work. The fund grows. Summer schools, winter schools, and so on are reinforced by the spirit. We're trying to weave together these elements in a pattern. Now, it's a struggle, and there are many challenges involved in it. But it's this pattern that we're aiming to create, a pattern of vibrant life in which all of these elements, just like the human body that has all these cells and organs and systems, yet all separate elements, you don't have life. You bring them together and you organize them in a certain way and you have the vitality of life. Now, in order for that pattern to be brought into being, the second thing that we need is the ability to think and to learn at the level of the cluster. It's not possible for such a pattern to be created in your cluster from Haifa or from Wilmette or from the level of the regional council. It has to come from within the friends in the cluster. So to learn how to think in a way within the context of the framework and guidance of the plan becomes the key challenge for the friends in the cluster. We have to understand what we're doing to such an extent that it's not waiting for directions from the outside. It's being able to take all this wonderful guidance, most recently just 11 pages more, and then see, well, what does it mean here in this context with these Baha'is, with this population, with these challenges, with these opportunities? How does it apply here? And in doing that, we have to avoid what becomes a tendency to reduce everything to kind of one extreme or another, to kind of dichotomies, which tend to always prove to be false. Either this or that. Either this is a formula and this is how you do it, ABC, like baking a cake, or, well, no, everybody can do what they like to do. You see, one tendency toward one extreme or the other. No, we have to learn how to weave these different elements together. And then we do something and it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? And somebody does it this way, and somebody does it this way, and somebody does it this way. This one works. Okay, let's do more of that. Unless that capacity to think and learn goes down right to the level of the cluster, then there's really not much hope of being able to move much beyond very fundamental levels in our activity. So this means developing the ability to think within the context of the framework of the plan rather than in terms of either-or kinds of questions. So recently when we happened to be in one community, there was a situation they were facing about should we have a booth at a fair? And so, well, either no, it's not part of the plan, I don't see it in any letter, therefore we should not have a booth at the fair. Or, we've always had a booth in the fair. What's wrong with the booth at the fair? Why don't we have a booth at the fair? And so this became the discussion, two groups, and then we'll kind of, all right, see who wins, you know, or what does the assembly say, or somehow, however we decide. But in fact, now think of the question in a different way. How do I think about this in the context of the framework of the plan? In other words, this structure, this vibrant pattern that we're trying to create in our community, does the concept of having this booth, does it fit in as an element of this pattern we're weaving in a productive way or not? So, for example, if we have the booth, will anybody talk to us? That's the first question. If not, well, we probably shouldn't have the booth. Why have it as an activity and nobody talks to us? But, all right, we have it. Yes, they do want to talk to us. Okay. So now what if at the booth, what happens usually in the past, somebody comes up to the booth, we give them a pamphlet, and we never see them again. All right? Right? Yes, that's what happens. Okay. So maybe we can do that differently. All right? What if sitting at that booth now are some of the friends who have been participating in some of our teaching activities? Maybe they've had some training in the Institute, Book 2, Book 6, and so on, and they've learned a few things, they've had some experiences, they've had a chance to practice putting this knowledge and action together, and they've gained a little insight into how to talk with people, how to carry on an elevated conversation, and also they know very well the pattern of activities that are going on in the cluster. So now the conversation with the person goes on something like, well, gauging the level of their interest in the faith. So if they are very, very interested, well, you can go as far as they're interested in going. But if that level of interest kind of hits a certain level, well, then maybe gauge where they might like to connect to this pattern of activity. If they're interested in prayer, maybe they would like to attend a devotional meeting. If they're interested in the welfare of their children, maybe they would be interested in learning more about Baha'i children's classes. If they're interested in having a Baha'i come visit them. We could arrange a home visit. If they're interested in studying more about the faith, maybe they would like to come to a fireside. Or for deeper study, maybe to, or systematic study, to come to a study circle. So now this process of a booth is not some abstract yes or no question, but thinking in the context of the framework of the plan, we can see whether it fits and how it fits to become productive. So in the past year, they've done this now 2 years. The first year, they had, say, I think it was something like 5 or 6 new Baha'is come as a result of this contact and bringing people. The last time, I heard a report that they had about 70 people who they contacted through the booth, who then became contacts for coming to various activities in the pattern of the cluster life. So more people than they were able to contact through their direct teaching activities in an intensive teaching phase came through one weekend at the booth by fitting it into the pattern of action they were trying to develop. Another example of this is like the idea where somebody was saying, well, I like to give deepenings on the Dawnbreakers. So, well, we're starting to get our process going here and so on. Well, can I give a deepening on the Dawnbreakers, or can I not give a deepening on the Dawnbreakers? Should we do deepenings, or shouldn't we do deepenings? And if we don't do them, how? So again, easy to see how this can break up into two camps and then become a big discussion. The individual who wants to do it, either I give a deepening on the Dawnbreakers, or I can't do anything, you're stopping me, I can only become an inactive Baha'i. Again, very extreme. Now, what if we think about it again in the context of the framework of the plan? Well, what picture do we see? Well, right now, our cluster is at a level where we have very few workers. So actually, if you had a deepening on the Dawnbreakers and you brought all of our active workers out of our process, the whole thing would stop. All right, well, not a good idea. That doesn't mean deepening is bad or deepening on the Dawnbreakers is bad. It means not right now, please. Now, that doesn't stop you from go finding 15 friends who aren't Baha'is and have them come and study the Dawnbreakers with you. Why don't you do that? Or 15 Baha'is who are not involved in this activity and we don't otherwise see, well, how about having the deepening for them? Or what about just not looking narrowly at the question of deepening on the Dawnbreakers? You like the question of the history of the faith and the early days of the faith. Maybe you would be a very good tutor of Book 4. Maybe you would be a very good person to do home visits. Here's a series of families. We don't see them very often. Why don't you go to them? Why don't you talk with them? Why don't you share some of the stories of the history of the faith and so on? And breathe that spirit. Keep that social connection with them and breathe the spirit of the faith into them. And as you make contacts with family after family, then you can pull them together and you can also have a deepening on some of these things. So again, we need to learn how to think in the context of the framework of the plan. It's not a formula. It's not a recipe. But it is also not everybody do everything that you want to do, and then it's fine. It's trying to walk a straight path between two extremes and learning how to weave these elements into a pattern and to think through how to make these elements successful and robust and vibrant. And that means that the friends at the cluster level, through the reflection meetings, through other gatherings, have to learn how to think about what they're doing and learn and talk and ask questions. And maybe there's not always answers to questions right away, but you try things and then you reflect on your action and you study the guidance again. A constant process of study, consultation, action, and reflection over and over again in meetings like reflection meetings, right after your fireside over a cup of coffee and so on, you're constantly thinking about what you're doing, what you've learned, and how to do it better. The last point I want to make in this area is about the same thing is true for the involvement of local assemblies. That's a question. Sometimes the local assemblies say, well, okay, what about us? You know, what is our role supposed to be? And then the question, again, creeps into this dichotomy of, well, either the cluster level agencies do everything and there's nothing for us to do, or we're the divine institution, we should be doing it. We're going to make our own plan, even though the cluster agencies want us to do something else. So again, I'm not saying, I'm sure no community's ever fallen into that discussion. But at least, let's say, we can imagine some tendencies to enter into such a discussion. Again, thinking in the context of the framework of the plan, you get quite a different picture. Again, to launch an intensive program of growth, maybe you get, 20, 30 people beginning to have a nucleus of activity in a cluster of maybe like 200 Baha'is and five local spiritual assemblies. Now, at that early stage of just trying to pull together the first 20 or 30 people, all right, there might not be a lot for a local spiritual assembly to do. What are we going to do? Five assemblies, we're going to divide up those 30 people. Each of us gets, what, six active ones or something like that. No. So at the early stage, yes, maybe it is a little bit of a focus on what the cluster-level agencies are doing and so on. But then what about even then with the local spiritual assembly? It's not left with nothing to do. All the other things it used to do, it still does. Baha'i marriage, you know, arrange for the feast, the fund, and so on. All these elements are still there. They didn't disappear. The only difference is the question of the element of teaching, which used to be, friends, do not move until the local assembly decides what the teaching plan is, and then you should do what we say, which I don't know about you, but my experience on local assemblies was it wasn't very successful. Time after time, you come after long deliberation, here's the plan. Maybe some activities would happen, but generally, the number of people were few, and the activities weren't sustained, or we did one thing after another. We weren't able to really raise this vision of a complex array of vibrant activities that are emerging in the plan. And part of this, we should think about, there's a big difference between, say, a process of building a building and raising a child. Before, we tended to think about the teaching work, the believers were waiting until we told them what to do. And so it's like if I'm building a little building, the bricks and the glass and the nails and the hammer and everything, they sit there until I do something with them. And then I go and I come back the next day and they're in exactly the same place. And then I move them around a little bit more. If at some point, well, I don't like that wall, now I knock that wall down and I build a different wall. All these elements are now obeying me and they don't move unless I say. Now we have a different context. Because of the institute process, because of the vision that has been given to the friends, they know that they're not their responsibility is to teach the cause and to act and not to wait any, as the guardian said, not to wait any special instructions from their assembly before they take action. But they should weigh the circumstances and the opportunities, and they should step forward and see with their talents and energy what opportunities do they have. So now they're acting. Now it creates a different context. If I went back the next day and the bricks all moved around on me, I'd have a very difficult time of building this building. So it's more like a child. If I'm a parent now, I don't expect that every time I tell my child something, when I go back, they're going to be in the same place. No, they're moving, they're acting, they're thinking, they're doing things. It's a constant process. They have their own internal process of growing and learning. And my role is much different than a, you know, builder. I can't control my child and make them do what I want. My role as a parent is to facilitate, help them, give guidance, build their capacity to make their own choices and to act in an appropriate way. So the role of the local assembly then, in this area about teaching, becomes different. Because now it's not that the friends will sit until I direct them. Now it's, thank God the friends are in motion. Now how do I support them? How do I encourage them? How do I help those that are not in motion to get into motion? So if in my community I have 40 people, 10 are actively involved in the plan, how do I make sure the other 30 are receiving some kind of support and insight and benefit, are participating in some activity, or how do they also get to the stage where they become active as well? So all of these are elements of how, not by falling into this false dichotomy and dividing every question into either or and one side and another and then arguing about it, but thinking about concepts within or questions within the context of the framework of the plan, then we can figure out how to continually create ever more productive patterns and solutions to the challenges we face in a cluster. Then, so the third element then, I think that we're struggling to do, besides trying to create this coherent, vibrant pattern, besides our ability to learn and think about that at the level of the cluster, the third challenge we're facing, I think, in each of these clusters is to achieve a universal participation in the work. So every Baha'i finds a part to play. We don't have so many Baha'is in the world. We don't have anybody to spare. the goal really of the institute process is to raise up more workers, because we didn't have enough workers then, and even with all the thousands we've raised since then, we still don't have enough. So every Baha'i should find some part to play. Every local assembly, the best assembly, is the one who helps everyone find some part to play. And whether somebody could initially begin by, whether through the institute process, whether through their own initiative, whether by accompanying them in some way to step into the field of action, whether they can get to the point where they initiate at least one activity on their own part, or whether they initially participate by going to something until gradually somebody helps them and then they can take the first step. We should see all of the friends in our cluster along this kind of continuum, along this path, and we should help them one by one to step into the field of action, initiating some pattern of action. And in this respect, if the cycle after cycle we look at our cluster, one of the ways of judging this vibrancy and development is if the number of people who are actively initiating some activity continues to grow. So cycle after cycle, one after another, we see more individuals participating. Now, in these areas I'm talking about, we're already beginning to see the fruits of it. So I'm not talking about theory. This is what we're doing, whether we're conscious of it or not. We're creating such patterns in clusters, and we're seeing the results of it in many different ways. So, for example, this vitality of clusters, there's different models of it in countries like Europe and so on, where the most dynamic clusters are appearing. What you're starting to see is a pattern where every night of the week, there's multiple kinds of activities going on. So again, you imagine, for example, a cluster of 300 people. If every one of them initiate one activity, all right, that means every day of the month, 10 activities are happening. Study circle, children's class, devotional meeting, fireside, all kinds of home visit, all kinds of different things, whatever you're interested in doing. Each person does one thing, 10 things are going on every night in different parts of the cluster, every day of the month. That's 300 activities. And that means that you are doing one thing and you are receiving the opportunity to participate in 299 other things initiated by other people. Much less if you do two things or you do three things. Imagine the vibrancy of that activity. Now 300 people doing different things and creating spaces and activity, not only for the Baha'is but also for their friends. All right, now that deepening on the Dawnbreakers actually fits in, because now 10 or 15 people do it, but you still have 285 people doing other things. You're not pulling your only 15 people off to the side in the process. So all these elements learn how to complement and reinforce each other. And in some of the larger clusters where we see even more significant growth, a totally different dynamic kicks in, where the number of people in the cluster are so active that the cluster-level agencies can't follow up with them anymore. Now you have 1,000 people or more than 1,000 people who are participating, or a percentage of those initiating activities on their own. How do you follow up? Well, now the local assembly steps in again. And so, for example, in the Tariki West cluster in Kenya, we have received reports of how the local assemblies are vital in mobilizing, following, catalyzing the energies of so many friends that can't be followed at the level of the cluster, because there's so many people doing so many different things in different ways. Another example we're seeing is the number of young Baha'is who are stepping forward and really searching about how they could have not only just a pattern of activity in the Baha'i community, but really a coherent Baha'i life through all of its elements and all of its phases, and to see how their service to the cause, their training, as junior youth and as youth, leads to putting this knowledge together with action to learn how to become an effective teacher, to learn how to talk to others, to learn how to deepen others in the faith, how to become a tutor and so on. But then also, how do I look at my studies? How do I think about my professional life? How do I think about finding a spouse and forming a family? And how will my family life be coherent with my work for service to humanity. So in a series of conferences, in different reports that are coming from different parts of the world, we see young, vibrant, capable Baha'is thinking in a very different, dynamic kind of way about their life and about the opportunities that they have in each phase, whether it's as a junior youth or in high school or in the period that I have where I can move around a lot in service or where I go off to study and I have the opportunity to focus and so on. So this is another element of the vitality and distinctive aspects of the plan we're seeing. But I think one of the most remarkable things is something the House of Justice talked about in the Rizwan message, which is reports that are coming in from the junior youth groups in different parts of the world. And I just want to read a couple of extracts from these reports so that you can hear from these young people how their thinking is changing and how their ability to look at the world and really begin to overcome some of the significant forces that are at work in the world is being manifested. One young woman said that after starting with a junior youth group, my character changed greatly. Before, I would just be busy with housework. Afterward, I would also teach the children's class, and I would start tutoring. So in that community, girls just stayed in the house. They even sometimes cut off their education and stayed home, and they just did chores. But suddenly, this young lady is discovering that she can be in the world and be effective in acting in the world. I started to go to different places, and I also went to a nearby village to teach a class. Now I do it all over. Before, I didn't feel like leaving the house, but now it seems to me wherever I go, I should learn something. And another young girl said, before, my family used to say that girls should not go out. But now they say, no, daughters and sons are equal. She will go out. And she will study and learn. So imagine this. Forces like the inequality of men and women that have acted for centuries. Now, just through the simple activity of a junior youth group, you start to see, I don't want to over-exaggerate what we're doing. We're just learning. We're just starting. We have a few books we're working on. We have a lot more to learn. But already you see the potentiality of this to change social processes that have been holding women back for centuries. Another example. The worst thing in this village is caste prejudice. People fight because of caste. It seems to me that we need to change this caste prejudice very urgently. We should live together in unity. For example, if someone is of a higher caste and you are of a lower caste, the higher caste people will not let you set foot in their house. But I don't think this way. I think that they have to come to my home. So they should sit with me and pray with me. As we read in the junior youth books, we should live in unity so that all prejudices will come to an end. If people study this book, they will become educated. If those who are unaware learn this, they can progress. Okay. How long has the caste system existed in India? And what efforts has been taken to try to undermine it and overturn it? And yet this process, based on insights from the Baha'i writings, change the heart of a young person. And they see and they think and they act in a different way. Another example, this from Kenya. At the time, if you remember 2002, 2007, 2008, there was political unrest in Kenya and the tribes were fighting one another along tribal lines. There was this young lady talked about the time that the Kenyans were fighting. They were just trying to burn people's houses. Our tribe, I don't want to say the names of the tribes, but one tribe, and the people trying to burn our house were the people of another tribe. They tried to burn our house, but they were not able. They didn't want to know if you were inside or outside. They were just burning things. If they found you, they just cut you to pieces. When we slept in the garden, we would just hide ourselves. Yes, we were scared, but my mother said, God will help us. We slept in the garden for a few weeks. And during that time, we said prayers all the time. The other junior youth, then after the unrest settled down, then the other junior youth of our tribe told us that we don't even want to meet with those young people of the other tribe. They're always were quarreling. But, she said, they are our friends. I don't feel that I should hate them. They are just our brothers. So this insight also gained from one of the books, which talks about a very similar instance where a young boy lost his parents and was in the process, as the story unfolds, he was encouraged to grab a gun and shoot the people from the other tribe who killed his parents. He refused to do it. He was helped by somebody of the other tribe. Finally, he ends in a refugee camp where the people learn to work together. This young lady drew on that example to see how she should also act under such circumstances. Finally, one youth said, giving a sense of this overall vision, starting from this village, we will bring peace to the village, then a state, the country, and the world. And in this way, we will become united and live in harmony. So this is the vision that is being created in these young people. So what are the social problems that we're facing in the United States? What is it? Disunity, extremes of wealth and poverty, racial prejudice, inequality between men and women. Well, to what extent do we see in our junior youth activity the potentiality to overturn these forces that are afflicting in our society? It might seem like an unglamorous thing. I would like the National Assembly to have a national campaign to do this and solve this problem. Well, it doesn't work that way. But I will go and I will get a group of junior youth and I will change the life of 10 young people and change their vision. And so that then how they live their life and how they see their role as becoming active agents in contributing to resisting these disintegrating forces in our society and working for a world of unity, that's not quite so glamorous. And it's a lot of hard work and maybe to do two groups and so on. Well, but latent in this process, as we build that capacity, as we work with tens and hundreds and thousands and tens of hundreds, then hundreds of thousands of junior youth in the United States, then you have the power of a social movement, a force capable of resisting some of these afflicting forces in our society. And that's just one element of this pattern that we're trying to create in all of its elements across all age levels, you know, in neighborhoods all across and clusters all across the country, to create such patterns that will put people in touch with Baha'u'llah's teachings and help them learn to translate it into reality and action in their own lives. Now, friends, I want to say just a little bit more. I'm going to impose on you for a little bit more time. The next question really is the one about where we're going. And, of course, there's not too much I can say about it. You have the 1 year of the plan. You have then the next plan, which will be a 5-year plan once more. And we'll begin, already you can see a little bit of hints from the House of Justice about the direction. Obviously, everything we're doing so far will continue to be carried forward. But the next plan won't be like the current plan. It won't be, okay, 1,500, go get 1,500 more. It's not going to be like that. We're going to have to keep thinking now as we think about the cutting edge of our work in these clusters, how to continue to advance that process, to carry it to a higher level. So now as we begin to see growth and the number of Baha'is in the place grow and this vibrant pattern emerge, well, suddenly these friends are drawn into the life of society around them. So what people are talking about, the problems that they have, the actions that they need to take to begin to address these problems. This becomes a reality for the Baha'i community. It's not something, as you bring people to you, all their reality comes with it. And so, again, we have to learn not only to draw insights from Baha'u'llah's teachings into how to act to grow the faith and create such patterns, but we have to draw insights from the teachings and then begin to apply it to these issues that concern humanity, to learn how to engage in discourse, to learn how to engage in social action at the level of the cluster, weaving in that same learning process of study, consultation, action, and reflection, another element into the pattern of activity of our cluster life. At the same time, much of the work in this plan has been achieved through some of the strongest countries in the world. About 20-some countries contributed 1,000 intensive programs of growth. The other 160-some countries contributed 500 intensive programs of growth. So we have to learn how to work with some of those countries that are not as strong and build their capacity and help them to build their national center, build their network of institutional structures and so on, strengthen their growth process so that those countries also become stronger. So these are just some of the elements. Obviously, it's impossible until the House of Justice finally says it to say, but suffice it to say that if you look at the tenure crusade, you can see that during the time of the Guardian, because of the patient work that he did over many years to teach the Baha'is about administration, to learn how to have a plan, to learn how to execute a plan, to learn how to be effective in teaching. Finally, at the start of the tenure crusade, he could draw the 12 national communities that existed at the time into one unified plan. And more was accomplished in the tenure crusade than had been previously accomplished for the growth and development of the faith in the previous century. So no doubt, as we look ahead, we'll see that the struggles and efforts that we put into this 15 years of learning how to become more systematic in our efforts, as we begin to apply that with a lot more knowledge and a lot more experience and a lot more people joined together and a lot more capacity for learning rather than falling into these dichotomies and so on, what we'll be able to accomplish in the next 10 years leading to the end of the first century of the formative age is limitless in its possibilities. The capacity to train millions, the capacity to have hundreds of thousands of teachers of the faith in innumerable clusters across the world. This is the potentiality that lies before us. Now, in order to achieve this, I think there are also a bit of a word of warning. There are certain pitfalls, again, that we can easily fall into in our efforts along this path. And I think we have to learn to be aware of these things. We have to be conscious so we don't fall into these pitfalls. One I talked about a little bit was this tendency to create dichotomies and argue. We have a sense sometimes in our mind that because we have problems, well, there's something wrong with that. That somehow we aspire to some good old days of the past when we never had any problems. Or to some imaginary future where once we get there, everything will be perfect and we won't have problems. But these two things are illusions. They don't exist. You know, that reality you have, idealized, romanticized vision of the past, wasn't true. We also had problems then. And when we go into the future, we'll also have problems there. It's natural in human beings that as we advance and learn, we make mistakes. Why are we surprised when we make mistakes? Why do we become so concerned about it? Because mistakes are inevitable. If your baby, as I've said other times, if your baby takes a step and falls down, you don't throw that baby out because it's defective and makes mistakes, doesn't know how to walk. You know, you see that as a developmental stage. It's natural. I know my baby's going to take a step and fall down. I'm not surprised by that. I cheer the first step. So the same way we have to think about our activities. This is the way human beings learn and grow and develop. Naturally, mistakes will emerge. Of course they will. And yes, we will have problems in the future. The thing is, in the future, we don't want the same problems we have today. We want new problems, you see. We'll solve these problems, and then we'll go to the next stage, and then we'll have new problems. And that will continue for 1,000 years, continually new problems. How do you have a Baha'i state? I don't know. Well, that'll be a problem we'll have to face in the future. But first we'll have to figure out how to sustain a vibrant process of growth in a cluster. You see, that's our problem now. And so we have to face that challenge. But this, again, is a shift from a kind of success-failure mode to one of learning, where we see mistakes as a natural part, and we study, consult, act, and reflect in order to solve those challenges and then advance to the next stage. If we have and continue to have this mindset of success-failure, what happens is we fall into a pattern, and it, again, becomes a kind of a enervating pattern. It drains our souls and causes friends to become inactive. We take two sides. We end up fighting it out. On the one side is the formula. This is the way to do it, and I know how to do it. So if you're not doing what I say, now, oh, well, then you're not faithful to what the House of Justice is asking. But well, how do I know what I think is actually what the House of Justice is asking? Maybe they're not being faithful to what I think the House of Justice is asking, but that's a different thing from saying that they're not being faithful from what the House of Justice is asking. So we have to avoid that extreme of turning it all into formulas. But then we have to avoid the other extreme of seeing somehow that what this person is saying is somehow a test. That person, the board member said, don't have firesides, just have study circles, but I know we should have firesides. So then, instead of just thinking, well, okay, that's a mistake probably, let's see, let's ask the board member, where did the House of Justice say that, or politely, of course, but if I don't think that, okay, let's see what happens, or let me write to the House of Justice, and then there comes the answer, problem solved. Instead, if I go to this other extreme, instead, now I think, no, that board member is a zealot. And then I start talking to my other friends and say, yes, the Baha'i faith is being overtaken by zealots and so on. And what happens is that we talk to one another, our discussion becomes more and more extreme, and it crystallizes. And then suddenly, every evidence we see, every mistake proves the plan doesn't really work, you see. And every good thing, well, that's probably going to go away after a little while, you see. It's hard because we get trapped. We trapped ourselves in our own discussion. Suddenly now, it's not just that board member who said something 5 years ago and now isn't saying that anymore, but we keep referring back to it. Now, everybody who supports the plan is a zealot, you know, and now we have the zealot and the non-zealots and so on. And so where am I then? If I get trapped in that discourse, I become left out. Now there's no place for me in the plan and so on, and somehow I've defined myself as the Baha'i who's not active in the divine plan. Such a thing can't exist. So we have to always check ourselves on this one side. In other words, mistakes are inevitable, we're going to make them, but we should try as much as we can not to reduce the guidance down to a kind of a recipe or formula that leaves a lot of people out. On the other hand, we should also avoid this kind of discourse among, if we feel kind of left out or displaced in some way, that then tends to reinforce us and draws us further away from the faith rather than into it. There's one statement, there's a story in Portals to Freedom where Howard Colby Ives talks about Abdu'l-Bahá, and one of the things he notices about Abdu'l-Bahá is he says Abdu'l-Bahá had this idea, or this is the way Howard Colby Ives imagined it, that is, Abdu'l-Bahá looks at every soul and knows that the true question that that soul has is a search for its beloved. So every human being is in search of the manifestation of God, is in search with the connection. They're hardwired for it. They're built for it. Whether you know it or not, whether you're consciously seeking or not, you're built to seek out the word of God and respond to it and find the divine message. And you long for it. And no matter what you ask or what you're concerned, somehow the real question is that behind it. And so Abdu'l-Bahá, Howard Colby Ives mentioned, Abdu'l-Bahá would often like not seem to not answer his question and answer some other question. But really what he was doing was getting it to the heart of that question. So, and another element of that is Abdu'l-Bahá would, the way he would answer would be right for the person where they are. In other words, he wouldn't answer above the capacity of that person. So if all they could understand is, you know, a few jokes and a story about the spiritual relief of laughter, that's what he told them. And if a mother was worried about her child, that's what he told her. You see, he would see where every soul was in its development and not speak over the capacity of that soul, speak right to it. And so, for example, one example was Howard Colby Ives said he asked Abdu'l-Bahá once, why should I follow Baha'u'llah? And Abdu'l-Bahá looked at him, and then he said, not many people are called to be ministers of Christ. He said, it's a very special thing. Many people have filled this role and their life has borne no fruit. It's been wasted. He said, you're a minister of Christ. You should be an excellent one. You should carry the true spirit of Christ to people. And he talked along those lines. Because Abdu'l-Bahá knew what Howard Colby's eyes, ability to respond, what he could hear, and that if he could put him on this path of true spiritual reality and true spiritual action, he would find the way to his beloved, rather than making a whole bunch of rational arguments about why somebody should be a Baha'i and so on, that they weren't ready to hear. And I think maybe, I could be wrong, but I think a little bit to some extent that there's also a question that lingers in the heart of every Baha'i, whether we're conscious of it, whether we're aware, whether we express it. Sometimes we say other things. We make other arguments. We express other things. But I think also, if I might draw a parallel to what Howard Colby Ives is saying, I think to a certain extent, the real question is something else in our heart, which is, as a Baha'i, do I adequately recognize and serve my Lord? I've recognized Baha'u'llah, but is my understanding of what he said and my service to him, is it accepted by him? Is it worthy of him? Is it appreciated by him? We all have that feeling in our heart. We all want that. And so then sometimes, on another level, when something comes up, and then it looks like the Baha'i faith moves somehow, suddenly somebody's saying something I didn't know before. Well, then I guess my understanding about Baha'u'llah really wasn't really complete. Or I'm being asked to do something different than I did before. Or somebody might even be telling me, as a mistake, but nevertheless they're telling me, that I shouldn't do this thing that I love to do in service to the faith, thereby questioning whether the service that I give, is it really worthy or not. So on one level, we're arguing about should we have a neighborhood class or should we have a centralized school and so on. But at the heart of that is somehow our connection to Baha'u'llah and our sense of, you know, is what we know and is what we do acceptable to him. And so I think if we can learn then the lesson that Abdu'l-Bahá taught to Howard Colby Ives and apply it in this context, then I think we'll start to see this vibrant pattern of community life. If we can know in the heart of every Baha'i is this is what a Baha'i wants to do, to know and to serve. And then we can see where they are. They might not be ready to be at the forefront of the work in the cluster, but that doesn't mean that what they have to offer isn't important. And so we should be able to hear their question, hear their anxiety, hear whatever it is they're saying about their concern, understanding, misunderstanding, right understanding, wrong understanding, whatever it is, and then be able to respond in a way that reassures that friend and gives them a part and confirms their sense of where they are and what they have to do and the part they have to play. And I think if we're able to do that, then we'll find universal participation will fall into place. Then we'll find this vibrant pattern of activity and the environment in which so many more can come and be exposed to the Word of God. And then we'll also see then our capacity to think about what's going on and not to fall into these false dichotomies, but see to the heart of the matter and speak to the needs of people and learn how to act within the framework of action and advance this process of civilization building. One last potential pitfall, I want to say, and again, friends, I know I'm going long and I've preempted all the questions. I'm asking all the questions and answering them for you tonight. But one last thing which I think is important is, there's a kind of negative force that, and this is separate from anything else, it's something that is in the world and we should be conscious of it, which is ever since the earliest days of the faith, Baha'u'llah talks about the idle fancies and vain imaginings, the idle talk of people, the slander, the calumnies, the lies that are directed against the faith and against the central figures of the faith, and how these stories are often spun up, sometimes in very sweet ways, which gradually undermines the faith. We see it in covenant breaking. Abdu'l-Bahá says, all they do is go around putting out the candles that we've lit. But we see it also in the forces at work from the enemies of the faith, where here we're doing our best to be Baha'is, to understand, to act, and so on. And yet, this story is woven, and it's whispered in our ear, and it's trying to seduce us in a certain kind of direction. It happened when people talked about Baha'u'llah. Why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? And so on. What about Abdu'l-Bahá? Calumny, lies, half-truths, so on, against him, slander. Why is Abdu'l-Bahá taking all the power of the faith in himself? Why doesn't he give any money to his brothers? He has all this money from Baha'u'llah. Why doesn't he give it all these whisperings, flatteries and whisperings to kind of attract people. Same thing during the life of Shoghi Effendi. We see it in the example of Iran. Now, we know the Baha'is in Iran, but read the press, read the Iranian press. What do they say about Baha'is? Baha'is are a community of spies, you know? Well, you can see it in the paper. There's a television show. Look at how Baha'u'llah and the Bab are conspiring against the good people of Persia with the Russians and so on. Well, it must be true. It's on television, right? And so, again, one lie after another. Baha'is are communities of spies. Now, wait a minute. Let's just think about this rationally just for a minute. What's a community of spies? You know, they're spies, yes, but a community of spies? If a woman has a baby, is this now a baby spy? So on face value, this is ridiculous. You know, it's an obvious lie. But you pump out that lie and all the media, and you tell it for a century, and pretty soon, well, people are going to believe it. They're just going to accept it. It becomes the truth, even though there's not a grain of truth to it. It's a systematic lie. Baha'is are spending money to get people to become, offering money, material inducements for people to become Baha'is, not happening, and so on. So all this is what the Baha'is in Iran are facing. We see it crystal clear. It's a pure lie, and we don't accept it. And we see now that even Iranians are not buying it anymore. So we see recent statements by intellectuals and by various organizations and by various individuals that support the Baha'is, that see that the veil of this lie has been pierced. And now people see that the source is telling a lie and that the reality is something else. But only after more than a century of spinning this lie and so on. Recently, a few months back, we started to receive in Haifa from a lot of different sources, individuals, institutions, and so on, a short email that was being sent around, making the rounds in Persian. First originated from some source, but then for some reason was also kind of bounced around in the Baha'i community. Then the Baha'i saw it, they sent it to another Baha'i and another Baha'i, and then individuals would become alarmed, they would send it to us. I'm not quite sure why all the friends were sending it around. Maybe they heard it, maybe they were alarmed, they were checking or whatever. But this is the translation of this story. Following the recent resignation of two members of the World Center of the Baha'is, for the House of Justice, various questions arose surrounding this resignation. A local newspaper from Haifa reports that the origins of the resignations lies in differences of opinion between members of the House of Justice regarding several cases of financial impropriety and misuse of funds in current social and economic development projects. One staff member of the center told the above newspaper that there has been serious disagreements between the two members who resigned on the one hand and two other members of the House of Justice, and they named those members on the other. It's worth noting that the other members of the House of Justice are attempting to resolve this conflict, and the possibility exists that the concerned members may in fact withdraw their resignations. Now, they did name two members of the House of Justice, and they did get their names right, although they misspelled them. But other than that, there's not a shred of truth in this whole thing. No local assembly reported it, or no local newspaper reported it. Sounds very convincing. Staff member has insider information, reports to a local newspaper, here's the real inside scoop, and so on. Well, we tried to find this local newspaper, doesn't exist, couldn't find any such report, and so on. Anyway, this is spun, it starts circulating around and so on. What do we make of it? Well, suddenly this message is followed up by other messages, and the story continues to unfold. The second message says another member of the House of Justice has now also resigned over this issue, Mr. Paul Lample. Imagine my surprise upon receiving a copy of this email. And so finally, then another message comes, and it starts then raising questions. Well, what about this House of Justice anyway? You know, why does an infallible body have to be elected every 5 years? Wait a minute, what kind of a question is that? You see, the implicit thing is there's something wrong here. Well, why is it elected every 5 years, friends? Abdu'l-Bahá said it should be elected. Shoghi Effendi said there should be a term, and the House of Justice will set it. And the House of Justice said it should be every 5 years. That's why. Nothing, no sinister stuff going on here. Obedience to the divine guidance is going on here. But you can see then, now comes a whole story to start to weave doubts, insinuate things, suggest things, to create a reality that has no reality, that is just pure smoke and mirrors. But the story is being told and then whispered. And then now we get it as Baha'is. What do we do with it? What do we make of it? We share it with one another and so on. What would send it to the world centers? Well, friends, this is just the beginning. You know, it's not something that's why I'm mentioning it. It's absolutely absurd, and it has no basis. But the fact that it could be presented in a way that would suggest it has basis, and then used as a platform to start weaving other arguments into it, starts to point to us, warns us, I think, alerts us to certain, you know, possibilities of what we might face in the future. We know, for example, that Shoghi Effendi talked to us about Abdu'l-Bahá's often repeated statements that the friends in the West would face severe mental tests. They wouldn't face the kind of persecution that's going on in Iran. They would face severe mental tests. Well, to some Baha'i, this might be a severe mental test. Look what's going on. It's in the newspaper. A staff member reported it. You know, well, it's all fabrication. You know, so we shouldn't underestimate the fact that what we're seeing in Iran in terms of the attempt to spin a certain story and take perfectly reasonable facts and then try to twist them and distort them and imply that something is wrong, something sinister is going on, something's wrong with the faith, fundamentalists have taken over, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is all designed with a specific purpose. It's not done by accident. It's not random gossip. You know, it's done by those who don't have the best interest of the faith at heart and whose aim is to put out candles. If not directly, to draw you against the faith, to take away your light and to have you not participate. And this is an inevitable part of the process of being. And the more we become, the more we grow, the more we directly become involved in the life of society, the more the influence of Baha'u'llah's teaching spread, the more we're going to see this kind of thing. So we should become aware of it. We should become conscious of it. I'm not talking about then, again, going to extreme. Now it's about blind faith and so on. Baha'u'llah doesn't ask us to follow him blindly. He asks us to study and understand and see with his eyes and not through the eyes of others. Interestingly, Baha'u'llah himself talked about the phenomenon of newspapers. He talked about swiftly appearing newspapers, which are like the mirror of the world. But he said, concerning this wrong one, most of the things reported in the newspapers are devoid of truth. And he states, fair speech and truthfulness, by reason of their lofty rank and position, are regarded as the sun shining above the horizon of knowledge. So newspapers are a powerful tool for the advancement of society, but only if there's fair speech and truthfulness. You see, not if then the media itself becomes a means for propaganda, basically. And Baha'u'llah warns us, sanctify your ears from the idle talk of them that are the symbols of denial and the exponents of violence and anger. The hour is approaching when you will witness the power of the one true God triumphing over all created things and the signs of his sovereignty encompassing all creation. On that day, you will discover how all else besides him will have been forgotten and come to be regarded as utter nothingness. So our faith, it shouldn't be blind faith. It shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't use our minds. God gave us our minds. We should understand what Baha'u'llah said. We should be conscious. But we should see the world through the vision that he gives, recognize him, and see what he says in his teachings. And then we'll be in a position to withstand, you know, the false realities that people are trying to weave. If the friends in Iran read what was in the newspapers and believed it to be true, there would not be any Baha'is in Iran, you know. And because they stood steadfast, now we see the minds of the Iranians changing. Now whatever's written isn't believed. because of their steadfast and patience. And we'll have to do the same at some point in terms of this mental test, whatever its form will be. Now, friends, then I want to conclude now. And to go back to my initial point and recall, you know, what the significance of this enterprise is that we are engaged in. We're struggling in our love for Baha'u'llah to learn how to translate what he wrote into reality and action, to build communities where people can be exposed to his word and participate in an environment based on the reality of his teachings. And we're making mistakes, and we're struggling, and we're learning. The thing is that whatever our struggles, what we can see very clearly is right now, you know, we look around, we see some of these 1,500 clusters. On the one hand, we're celebrating. On the other hand, we say, well, some of them are pretty weak and so on. And that just shows us the nature of our progress is such as that if we think back to the beginning of the plan when we didn't have many intensive programs of growth, even to have weak ones would be, you know, quite a good thing. Now we have the weak ones, we say, well, these are not very good and so on. So the nature is always that the strengths of the beginning of the plan become the weaknesses of the end of the plan, you see? And that means we're making progress. And so, yes, now we're not satisfied with weak ones. We want our clusters to look like those strong clusters look like. Well, at the end of the next plan, the strong cluster of today will look weak to us again. That means we're advancing. And so that's the continual nature of the process in which we're engaged. So just as the Baha'is in Iran are willing to sacrifice whatever it takes, their opportunity to study, you know, their opportunity to earn a livelihood in a certain way and so on, their ability to kind of go unmolested by the society around them in order to vindicate the truth of Baha'u'llah's teachings in his homeland, where even those who are finally forced out, still have the opportunity then to put the teachings into action, to reach out to their fellow citizens who are also out of the country, or to teach the faith wherever they live. So we too, who have freedom, also should think in those terms, to make the level of sacrifice necessary of our time, our energy, our resources, our opinions, in order to make this process advance, vibrant, growing, so that this potentiality we only dimly see in the junior youth reports can grow and develop and gradually give us the capacity to create a new civilization, free of these forces and ones that reflect the oneness of humanity, the teachings of Baha'u'llah. I want to conclude with the last paragraph of the Rizwan message. Dear friends, how often did the beloved master express the hope that the hearts of the believers would overflow with love for one another, that they would abide no lines of separation, but would regard all of humanity even as one family. See no strangers is his exhortation. Rather, see all men as friends, for love and unity come hard when you fix your gaze on otherness. All of the developments examined in the preceding pages are, at the most profound level, but an expression of universal love achieved through the power of the Holy Spirit. For is it not love for God that burns away all veils of estrangement and division and binds the hearts together in perfect unity? Is it not his love that spurs you on in the field of service and enables you to see in every soul the capacity to know him and to worship him? Are you not galvanized by the knowledge that his manifestation gladly endured a life of suffering out of his love for humanity? Look within your own ranks at your dear Baha'i brothers and sisters in Iran. Do they not exemplify the fortitude born of the love of God and the desire to serve him? Does not their capacity to transcend the cruelest and most bitter persecution bespeak the capacity of millions upon millions of oppressed people of the world to arise and take a decisive part in building the kingdom of God on earth? Undeterred by divisive social constructs, press on and bring Baha'u'llah's message to waiting souls in every urban neighborhood, in every rural hamlet, in every corner of the globe, drawing them to his community, the community of the greatest name. Never do you leave our thoughts and prayers. And we will continue to implore the Almighty to reinforce you with his wondrous grace. Thank you very much, friends.